science, learning, business, community, you. Welcome to Think Works, the podcast for people who like to think. Because thinking is the hardest work there is. Come with us on a journey into the world of ideas with your host, Darren Smithson.
A dark winter night in a Canadian metropolitan city. The streets are carpeted with a blanket of snow. Snowflakes are still falling heavily. A few cars make their way along the road slowly, headlights and taillights illuminating the scant numbers of people braving the sidewalk. In amongst them, a tall man wrapped in a hooded waterproof pushes his worldly goods in a trolley through the snow blanket. He pauses at a shop front momentarily and then rubs away the flakes from the window with a gloved hand. Peering into the shop front, he sees it is actually a comic book store. Comics, books, merchandise all paint a fantasy world behind the glass. Centerpiece in the window display is a plastic CGC slabbed comic book, The Human Fly Number 1. The exorbitant price seems completely outrageous to him at that moment, and he shakes his head momentarily. Then, pausing to think, a faint smile breaks through his rough gray beard, and he whispers to himself,
"Long time ago, I guess. No one would believe me anyway. But what a ride."
Whistling to himself, he carries on his journey into the night. Falling snowflakes once again obscure the shop window, and the world of fantasy behind the glass disappears once again.
So we're here to talk about the human fly, the greatest superhero that there ever was, because he's real. So when you mentioned that the story of the human fly to me, it would be a fantastic movie. And then more we looked at it, the more we went, do you know what? Actually, this podcast could well have a fascinating story to tell. So why don't we start with that, the actual story itself?
Of the real, as far as we know, character.
Okay. Yes.
Well, it begins with, as all good superhero stories should begin with, a meat factory in Montreal.
Of course it does.
Which is Roma Meats in Montreal, which was run by the Ramassieri family, and specifically at the time two brothers, one of whom was Joe Ramassieri, and they were part of the family business. But Joe had other ideas. He's been working there since he was 6 years old. He was fed up of it. He wanted to be a musician. Apparently he had musical talent, but he used to go to a piano teacher.
Right.
And the piano teacher told him he was useless. It was only years later he found out that the piano teacher had been paid by his dad to tell him that, because his dad didn't want him to depart from the family business. But Joe was a dreamer. And I think if you can, I think we need to take a step back now. This is the mid-70s.
Yeah.
Evel Knievel.
Yeah.
Was a key figure. Evel Knievel, as everybody I'm sure listening knows, was a stuntman who basically jumped over things on a motorbike until one day he tried to jump. I think he wanted to jump the Grand Canyon in a rocket. That never happened. They wouldn't let him. So he actually bought his own canyon, Snake River Canyon, and tried to jump that in a steam-powered rocket. Didn't work. But he survived. I mean, he was an immensely colourful character, a real man's man. He was a playboy, he liked the ladies, he liked the booze. And he spawned one of the most successful toy lines ever, which ironically financed him. It wasn't the stunts that financed him. It was the royalty checks from Ideal Toys. And he was a prevalent character. Well, he was until he beat his publicist up with a baseball bat. Became the subject of a prison sentence and a $12 million civil lawsuit, which basically broke him. But I guess the likes of Joe must have seen that and thought, well, we can have a piece of that. We can, we can create a stuntman.
Yeah.
Put him in the frame and reap all the benefits. I mean, who wouldn't want the royalty checks from the associated toy line, etc.? Now, this is where everything about the human fly, as you and I have talked about, Darren, is basically the account of somebody else.
Yes.
Got to tell his story through other people. Now, apparently, the story, this may be the true story. They came across a guy called Rick Rojat who told them he was a stuntman. Now, stories differ as to how they knew him. Somebody said he worked at the meat factory. Others said his cousin worked at the meat factory. And apparently, Rojat owed his cousin money. Anyway, somehow they got together. And Rojat apparently told them that he was full of metal plates and metal rods in his body because he'd worked at the ape house in the Florida Zoo.
Yeah.
And was against the wall by a menstruating female gorilla, which led to him spending a lot of time in hospital and being refitted lots of metal. Anyway, this guy was quite happy to take on any sort of outlandish stunts. So Joe raised, through the sale of his house and other
Yeah.
means, $200,000, which is probably a lot of money back in 1975, 76. It's a lot of money now. It was probably even more. It was obviously even more there to form humans. Fly Spectaculars Limited. So there we jump to another guy, a guy called Clay Lacy. He was one of the world's most famous test pilots and stunt
Yeah.
pilots. I think he'd done some of the James Bond stuff. In 1976, he got a call from, I assume, Rojat or Joe Ramazzieri asking, would he fly a Learjet with a guy stood on top of it? But not only that, would he fly it upside down so the guy was only, his head would only be a few meters from the runway? To which he said,
It's just
Exactly. To which, obviously, he said no. But he was trying to promote an air show in the Mojave Desert in summer 1976, and he did have access to a DC-8, apparently. So anyway, they rejigged the stunt whereby the fly would stand on top of the plane, and Clay would fly it around at 250 miles an hour. So they did this stunt twice in the Mojave Desert. And then once again, so not only did he do it once, he did it three times. And on one of the occasions, which was in Fort Worth, which is south of Dallas, I think, they ran into an unexpected rainstorm, and the human fly actually passed out because the force of the raindrops hitting him was like being shot with bullets. But by the time they landed, he actually passed out.
And this is where the comic also kind of mimics what happened, because in one of the comic issues they have him on doing the stunt on the aeroplane, and while he's trying to rescue the crew and some passengers because some naughty terrorists have got on board,
As
or
they do, as they
kidnappers,
did back in the day, as they did in those days,
the rain hits. And he actually makes the comment, I feel it's like being hit by bullets, and I feel like I'm going to pass out. I mean,
Apparently, that's what he said when they were putting him in the ambulance. He came round a bit and they were asking, was he okay? And he said it was like being shot with bullets. So obviously that raised the guy's profile. So I remember this. He appeared in newspapers and he appeared quite extensively, I think, obviously on American news broadcasts. And then I guess we turn to your bit, really. Somehow he gets a licensing deal with Marvel Comics.
Again, and all that is in is woven into the mystery about the human fly, because there's differing stories about how that came to be in the first place anyway.
Yeah, I mean, Jim Shooter, seems to think it came from one of Marvel's licensing team who would go to a licensing shows every year and come up with licensing deals. Sometimes they'd come up with licensing deals, apparently, for characters they didn't even own or didn't even publish. So that's how connected the licensing team were to the publishing side. That's one story. I think Steve Lealoa recounts that he thought Bill Mantlo, who's the writer of the series, actually knew some of the guys involved in Human Fly Spectaculars. And he certainly had some contact with them. So, I mean, who knows? But to be honest, Dan, give us a brief sort of summary of the Human Fly comic and how many issues it ran, etc.
So it ran from September 77, I think it was, and it ran for 19 issues. And the first kind of it was really interesting, because they positioned the human fly as obviously this real person. The origin was that he'd been in a car crash that had killed his daughter and his wife. and he had multiple bones broken, and he was never going to walk again. And through sheer willpower and multiple operations to replace 60% of his body with metal plating, he actually got himself walking again. And the story is, and this was then confirmed by the human fly in a letter to his own comic,
This
is.
became the narrative, I think, in interviews and TV shows. So this
It
is where
did.
the whole fantasy reality thing bleeds away
Yeah.
somewhere. It's blurred at the edges.
It is. And so the story then becomes his own doctors in this hospital told him, because he tried to get up and walk and obviously couldn't because they, and his own doctors and surgeons told him they'll get him so he can move, but he's got to stop this stupidity of trying to walk because it's never going to happen. So secretly at night, when the rest of the consultants were asleep,
As you
he
do.
would, as you do, he would get himself out of bed, and he would crawl, and then he would walk, and then so on. And then the other narrative aspect of that is whilst he was doing that, because he was in a specialized unit that was also treating soldiers from, was it the Vietnam War at that point?
Yeah, it had been just
Yeah.
yeah, the
It
end of the
just
Vietnam
finished, hadn't
War.
it?
Yeah.
So they were treating, obviously, soldiers that had been horrifically injured during the war in Vietnam. And so he came up, that's when he got that driving principle of saying, I want to show people what is possible, because he heard a Marine had, he'd just given up. He had, he didn't want any help. And so that fostered this idea of, I'm going to show people what's possible, and I'm going to raise lots of money for research and for charities helping disabled people, especially children. And that narrative was picked up by the comic. And then subsequently, as you say, in interviews the real human fly did on TV or radio, whatever, that narrative started to stick that he was doing it purely for charity, only taking expenses out. And the rest of the money was going to charities and research into bionics, I guess, and stuff like that to help people that lost limbs. And it was later confirmed because issue one actually had Bill Mantlo's editorial as a full page, which recounted the origin of the human fly as though it was fact about the car crash. Losing his wife and child, rebuilding himself, the whole process that we've just described. And then the comic in comic form, obviously, told that story, but didn't really dwell on, it didn't dwell on any emotional impact of the loss of the wife and child. It just focused on the human fly deciding that that's what he was going to be. And
Interestingly enough, actually, Joe Ramoscieri's wife, and there's really only one interview with her that I could find, and we'll do the references after if anybody wants to go down this rabbit hole. She said while they had Human Fly Spec, or while her husband was running Human Fly Spectaculars, she had a call from a lady who claimed to be Rodiak's common law wife, and expressed her dissatisfaction that he'd abandoned her and the two children, but she'd recognised him. From one of the interviews on TV, his voice, because he was a tall, thin guy, he was pretty distinctive, I think. Again, who knows? And apparently recounted to Joe's wife that her father was looking out for him, so to speak. So, I mean, again, who knows what the truth is really, but and maybe it's not quite as cut and dried as, Bill tried to make out in the editorial.
No, and then the human fly himself would write letters in, or answers to letters that readers were writing in, would again confirm this story over and over again that he was doing it all for charity, that he had witnessed while he was rehabilitating himself, he had witnessed these disabled, severely disabled people and injured people feeling that they had no hope, and so all this in issue became about him doing that. And it's really fascinating how the comic and the letters pages in particular then started to weave in and out of what the human fly was doing live in
Yeah,
front of
which I
the
guess
cameras.
was probably intentional in many ways. I mean, why wouldn't you? I mean, can you imagine if Evel Knievel had had an ongoing comic book? A, I'm sure it would have sold like gangbusters. And B, he could have promoted himself. Yeah, I mean, obviously the plane stunt, I remember it being in the seeing pictures in a British newspaper and then thinking, oh, crikey, no, hold on, there's a comic with this guy in. And that raised his profile. There's tons of videos on YouTube of him on a Canadian broadcasting company sort of early evening magazine program with his manager, which is quite an oily guy called David Levine, who sort of contributes as well. But the comic book was interesting because not only, I mean, to me, it was like, I think we've mentioned this before between ourselves, that it was almost like Marvel's version of a TV show, in that every week there'd be a situation. And I thought, there'd be a situation with similar to like the Fall Guy, which came along in the 80s. He was doing one thing, he'd get involved in the story. And then along the course of the story, he would be the almost reluctant hero in sorting it out, but sorting it out, he would do.
I mean, one of the
I
lines
mean,
that in the comic that the human fly kept saying was, "I'm not a superhero. I don't fight crime." Over and over again, he said that actually in the comic, and it was repeated in the answers to letters that were sent in by readers, by Bill or whoever was answering the letters at that time. And it was fascinating that they kept pushing that, and yet every episode he would come across criminal elements who
Well,
were
yeah,
trying to, as you
you
do.
know, possibly he did in real life as well, and we'll get to that in a minute.
So again, this history of weaving in and out of life and comics and what was really going on. It's absolutely I'd love, because what I did was I've never read all 19 issues in one go before. I've read an issue here, an issue there. I think the very first Human Fly comic I got was the one with the Human Fly teaming up with the Ghost Rider, Johnny Blaze. And so I never actually sat down and just read them as a bulk, and it was fascinating. Just because I'd already started, obviously from our discussion, started the research into the real human fly, so I already knew the basics. And then I'm reading this comic, I'm thinking, oh, that references that, and then oh, that references that. And there were many things that they tried to do in the comic. They tried to set up a human fly fan club. They try to do a suggested stunt for the human fly to do, and the one that gets the most votes, and so on.
None
So
of
they
which would have been as bizarre as the ones he suggested for himself, but we'll get to that in a
no,
minute.
we'll get to that in a minute. But then, and I think the comic at first was actually quite successful, and certainly the response from readers seemed to be mostly positive, but. And I miss that about modern comics, that they're actual readers' letters. But even people that were writing in with negative comments would then write back a month later and say, oh no, I see where you're going with this now, and actually I like it. So there was like this kind of, there was a buy-in from fans about him, because although they did say America's first superhero that's real in the first issue, and then had to correct it because obviously he's
He's
Canadian.
Canadian.
Yes, so there's all this buying from them all as well, which I just found really fascinating. But obviously, after the stunt that went wrong, he wasn't in the public domain anymore. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. But and then sales petered off because of that. So
I
the
mean,
two
some
had to
terrific
be
talent, you know.
seen.
Some terrific talent worked on the comic. I mean, Bill Mantlo, I think, is a hugely underrated writer. He's great at
Agreed.
world building, and he built a cast up, didn't he? And used that cast to sort of propel the story along. And he did some terrific work, like on Micronauts, a terrific world building from nothing really. Micronauts was a toy line, you know. The human fly was a stunt man, but he built storylines around them. I don't suppose listeners will need to be reminded, but he suffered a really tragic accident in 1992, and he was a victim of a hit and run driver in New York. He'd become, I think, a public defender by that time, a lawyer, and he suffered a severe head trauma, which has incapacitated him ever since. If anybody's interested, his daughter runs a page on Facebook
All
for him.
right, we'll put that link up.
I'd say I think his daughter's called Corinne, but you can find him on Facebook. And she encourages people who've enjoyed his work just to send him a card or a letter, and she reads them out to him. I corresponded years ago with his brother Mike Mantlo and donated some money, but Mike sadly passed away. But I think his care has, I think it's been enhanced by some royalty deal with Marvel over the likes of Rocket Raccoon and Guardians of the Galaxy. I recall reading that some years ago. And there were some great artists. I mean, and the best thing about the roster of artists, I thought, when the comic was coming out, was that there were all these guys. You didn't really appreciate them then, but they were the classic artists. You know, Frank Lee Elias had done Terry and the Pirates newspaper strip. Obviously, Frank Robbins was on In and Out a lot. I mean, he'd done Johnny Hazard. Bob Lubbers, I think, did a couple of really nice issues later on.
He
But I
did.
think he was a comic strip artist as well. And then some of the Incas as well, some of the classics, Don Perlin, Mike Esposito, Steve Lealoa apparently begged to ink an issue of Frank Robbins's. He actually, he
I bet that
requested
would
that
have,
assignment.
yes.
And he
So
talks
I,
about that extensively. And
yeah,
then I
it,
think that was Robbins' last color comics work. He moved to New Mexico and spent the rest of his artistic life as a painter.
yeah.
And you can find his paintings online quite easily, images of them, etc. Very successful, apparently.
And what I think what if listeners haven't ever read the comic, the artists that they picked were actually really suitable for the kind of narration that the
Yeah,
human fly had,
definitely.
because they were very fluid.
Yeah.
Poses weren't that typical superhero pose, but they were more kind of what would happen if you were being buffeted by supersonic
Correct.
winds, you know, just
Or thrown off motorcycles or whatever.
So it was very fluid and very motion oriented, the artwork, and I thought that was great. And you referred to the cast that Bill created, and I mean I've got some of the notes here. I mean Blaze, the pilot who was of Negro descent, which was she was the main
African-American, yeah.
character, and
Yeah.
again, just and it was just done. It was just she was just there as that. It wasn't made a big deal of. But reading a lot of the comics from that era, there were very few black people in supporting casts, especially in a prominent role like Blaze was. The thing that I did love was Harmony White,
Oh, the
the
reporter.
reporter. He
Yeah,
was
whose
very.
story arc sort of changed nicely as the issues went
He
on. I thought it was really
did.
clever, to be honest.
Because initially she starts off disbelieving that the human fly is doing all this for altruistic motives. And wants to expose him to be a cheat and a charlatan and everything else. And she's very much like Jack McGee in the Incredible Hulk TV series, which came a year later than the Human Fly comic. Very much on his case all the time, pursuing him, trying to find out secrets. There's an initial plot line put forward where she's narrowed it down to five potential people who could be the Human Fly. Because when he hasn't got his mask on, all we ever see is a from behind the head shot
That's
of him.
right.
So there's all that going on, but as you say, as this story changes, she starts to realize that actually he truly is a man who is trying to do the right thing for the right reasons. And wherever you start, yeah, it's a good narrative. Very,
Yeah,
very
I mean, a
good.
couple of background things. On if you search YouTube, there's something called Behind the Scenes Documentary at Marvel Comics. And it's quite general. It's only short, but the beginning of it is it's Archie Goodwin and Stan Lee sitting down with John Romita's character drawings from the Human Fly, and Stan commenting on each character as he's pulled up. And you can see how John Romita kind of, I mean, he had quite a good costume anyway, but John Romita made it better, to be honest. So that's kind of interesting. The other thing about it, and when you think it couldn't get any stranger, apparently the person who used to ferry the artwork from the to be approved by Human Fly Spectaculars and go and collect the royalty checks was Cyndi Lauper prior to and we'll speak about her a bit later, but prior to her own career. So again, it just gets stranger and stranger. My
It
favorite issues
does.
of the comic are 8 and 9, which is the team up with Daredevil, well, White Tiger, and later Daredevil. And then they've got that great villain of Daredevil's Copperhead, who's had a great sort of pulp quality. And there's a great line in the second issue where Copperhead says to the human, t White Tiger, sorry, who's Hector Ayala, so he hasn't transformed. He said, you will pay for this. And he said, no, I won't, senor. I'm unemployed. Beat that, Alan Moore,
There was a lot of humor in the comic. It has Bill Mantlo was actually, as you say, I think he was definitely an incredibly talented writer, but he was solid all the time. He was literally whatever
Jim
he
Shooter
did.
says in an article he was dependable, and he said in that sort of era when they were just looking for product, he said he was never late with a script and he would take on assignments nobody else wanted. Maybe nobody else wanted this one, but he would take on an assignment, and he said he was solid and he was professional. And I think he's really underrated. Some of his stuff's great, I think. Micronauts, the run he did after that on Swords of the Swashbucklers for Epic, I thought was great.
Yes, I
And then
love that
obviously, sadly,
series.
he just disappeared from view as far as comics fans were concerned, quite tragically. But I'd encourage anybody to take a look at the web pe the Facebook page, and send him a card,
We'll do. We'll definitely put that link up on the when we
Yeah,
do
good
the
idea.
post with the
Yeah.
episode. We'll put that link
So
up.
okay, so halfway through the comics run then.
Yes, they
Something
there's
else
a
happens.
yes. He decides he wants to out Knievel
That's it. Yeah.
and do a was it 36 buses originally he wanted
Well,
to
we get
jump.
to a guy. Again, it's got to be through somebody else, you see. We get to a guy called Kai Michelson. Kai Michelson was a rocket engineer. He used to do stuff for other stuntmen, film and TV. You can look him up. He used to have a website. He's actually got a company called Rocket Man Enterprises Incorporated. And he's got a website, and you can hear transcripts of stuff on YouTube, etc. And he's the real deal. He actually did the world's first commercial space flight in 2002, I think, where he got something like 72 miles or something into the Earth's atmosphere. So, beat that, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. Kai was first. So in 1977, he gets a phone call, unsolicited phone call from somebody. He thinks it was Rick Rojat, said that, yeah, he wanted to outdo Evel Knievel's bus jumping record on a bike. Three times over, so from I think from 12 to 36 buses. I think Michelson told him he was an idiot, but why doesn't he scale it down to 26 buses, so i.e. twice the world record? And what he wanted Michelson to do was take a Harley Davidson and add rocket engines to it.
Yeah, as you
So
do.
as you do, as you do. So, which is what he did. So he actually boosted the top end of this brand new Harley Davidson from about 120 miles an hour to 300 miles per hour, with a couple of caveats. He was told, not by Rojat apparently, he was told not to test it, never to test it. He did, apparently, he did in secret to see. And then another thing was, he said he got a call from an insurance company asking if the stunt was real, because somebody had just taken out a $1 million life policy on the human fly, which he thought was strange. Anyway, the bike was collected, and the deal was that Michelson and his team, including a very famous stuntman called Dar Robinson, who's worked in all sorts of movies and actually did stunts on the Doc Savage movie, I found out the other night. A couple of years earlier. So these guys were the real deal. Went up to Montreal, drove up to Montreal, where they met Ramaseri and his gang. He wasn't too impressed. I don't know if you've seen some of the footage, but he never appeared in the comic. But there was a guy who used to accompany the human fly to stunts called Mercury, a stocky guy with a Kevin Keegan perm, no mask. Apparently, he was a guy called Joe Lemo, who told Michelson when he asked what he did, he said he made concrete shoes for people. So make of that what you will. Anyway, they stayed up there. Michelson was very worried about the stunt, which was to take place in Montreal's Olympic Stadium in October 1977, as part of a Gloria Gaynor concert, which I just think is brilliant. Again, there's load of YouTube footage prior to the stunt taking place with the human fly and David Levine, his manager at the time, supposedly talking about it. The evening of the stunt arrived. Michelson and his team went to the venue to discover that basically, if he'd have undertaken the stunt, he would have sliced himself into some superstructure on the descent ramp,
Yeah.
As he said, it had been, sliced up like a meat slicer.
Yeah.
So they refused to actually take part in anything until the ramps were adjusted, which they were. Michelson says he was amazed that the guy ever, but apparently he came out very calmly, got on the bike, which he'd never ridden before,
Yeah.
asked Michelson, "What do I do?" He said,
What
"Bring it up,
was
bring the
it?
throttle up slowly, and then press the red button."
Yeah.
Again, it's all on. I'll get an unusual point in a minute, but it's all on YouTube footage. You can see he takes off this ramp, and the bike just goes end on end. He collapses into the ramp at the other end, and the bike lands on top of him.
Yeah.
And he came out of it amazingly. Maxon said he thought he was dead.
Yeah.
Everybody in the stadium thought he was dead, apparently.
Yeah.
And but he wasn't. He'd actually bruises, contusions, and actually only one broken ankle, and he was still
Yeah.
conscious. And there's footage of him being taken on a stretcher out, but still waving to the crowd. The consummate showman, the consummate
Yeah. Thumbs
showman.
up.
Yeah, and I just hope that, Gloria Gaynor sang "I Will Survive," at some point during the evening, which is just too good to miss. Now, I don't know if you remember, but this was so the comic was out by this time, and I remember this being advertised as being on World of Sport, which was on ITV on a Saturday afternoon. Dickie
Yeah,
Davis, if you remember that.
I do.
So I actually stayed in to watch it because I was so excited. They
Yeah.
never showed it the first week because they ran out of time. So I had to
Yeah.
wait a whole week and watch World of Sport again with its mix of racing and wrestling or whatever was on. But they actually showed it the second week, and obviously the human fly was never really seen again in public after that.
No, this is where the comic kind of, again, started to weave in and out of what was really going on. There was in let me just get this right. So in issue 8 of the Human Fly, in the letters page, they did a stop press and said, as you read this, the Human Fly has just done this world record attempt at buses and suffered a horrific crash, etc. We'll bring you more news next issue. And they kind of again it reinforces the idea that the human fly was 60% made of metal because
Of course,
how
yeah.
did he survive? I mean, it was just that
Correct.
was that kind of thinking. And then what they did was so they had a full recount of the incident in the letters page, how the what the stunt had been about, how he'd done it, where it was, what happened. And then in issue 11, they actually did the stunt. They wove it
Okay.
into the actual story. And the story, the narration then went on. He was horrifically injured again, etc., etc. But he raised all this money for charity and he wanted to show again that he could beat anything. And then very quickly, the comic picked up that he was back in action the next issue. He was still limping a little bit, but back in action. But what's interesting is the human fly wrote from apparently his hospital bed while recovering from the crash, again reaffirming that this was just the start. He'll be back. He's got more stunts lined up. And eventually we got to the point, I think it was issue 13, where the letter was published, and where he said he was also about to launch a musical career.
That's right,
Because he
yeah. Oh,
was
well, this,
going,
yeah.
yeah, he was going into the studio that very week to
Yeah,
start
well, Kai
recording
Michelson,
his.
sa yeah. Michelson says that a few weeks after, so basically, they got out of Montreal. They couldn't get out of the stadium initially because they had guys stationed with baseball bats preventing them. But when the whole stunt went wrong and the accident happened, although he
Yeah.
did break Evel Knievel's record at the time,
He
so he was
did.
a world record holder, they left the stadium in a hurry, went to the nearest car hire place, hired a car, and all got in it and drove to New York, apparently, and got a flight back home. But Michelson says somebody, he said Rojak phoned him, Rick Rojak phoned him a few weeks later and thanked him for saving his life, and was very critical of the people who were managing him. And he said, as far as he knows, he was never seen again. The other thing Michelson says was he realized when he spoke to him the second time that the first call was from Rojak. About making the rocket powered bike, and that he'd also met him at the meat factory, at the meat plant, when he'd gone to meet the other guys. And he was actually just working in the plant, but he said he had a distinctive voice, and he said he was this tall, rangy guy.
Yeah.
Now, a couple of things. Well, Eddie Kidd confirmed that apparently he'd been contacted, Eddie Kidd, the British stuntman, British stunt ride. He'd been contacted about sort of donning the suit and doing the stunt, but he didn't think the guys were bona fide.
Yeah.
Joe's wife said that Joe did hire other people to get in the costume and go around hospitals and sign autographs and pictures, etc. So she says that a guy turned up to sell her a vacuum cleaner, good-looking guy. One day she didn't want a vacuum cleaner, but Joe quickly ushered him into the hallway and said, look, do you fancy a job? I'll pay your expenses. So she said there were other people don the costume. And if you think about it, it's a great conceit, create a character, do different stunts and just put different people in there.
And if the main one gets injured or even killed, it doesn't matter because you've got continuity.
I mean, he never did another stunt after that. At the time, if you watch those interviews on YouTube, he promotes one where he's going to jump off the CN Tower in Toronto into 20 feet of water.
Yeah.
And also hang on to the side of a rocket, which they were going to launch from England over the English Channel into France. So.
Yeah. Never happened.
He might have been better breaking his ankle, to be honest.
Yeah, I think so. And what you were saying about the fact that they had hired other people to appear as a human fly, I'm wondering if, because shortly after, a couple of issues after the crash, they had a photo spread of the human fly in the Marvel bullpen.
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
With Stan, I think, as well.
Yeah,
Stan Lee.
Everyone was involved. He met Bill, obviously, and Frank. He met a couple of the other staffers. And you just think, but was it really him?
Well, again, one of the great things about this story is we don't know. But one thing, one thing we do know, you just hinted at it, to go from one bizarre career shift to another, apparently then launched a music career.
Yeah.
Was that reflected in the comics? I can't remember.
Yeah, there was so in the comic that followed immediately after the comic that recounted the crash, the human fly is recovering and he's picked up a guitar and he's learning some rock songs as part of his recuperation to focus on something other than the stunt that went wrong, because it's apparently hurt his confidence a little. That's the only after effect that is mentioned in the comic. And there's a plot in the comic where that he's going to do a stunt after a rock star's done a concert. And the rock star, his agent, has taken out $1 million insurance contract on him because the agent has secretly been embezzling funds for all the time the rock band have been in business and there's no money left. And the musician gets electrocuted and killed. And then that spurs the human fly at the end of the issue, because he uncovers all this, obviously, because he has to, because he's not a crime fighter, but that's what he does.
No.
And
it's the story of the week. It's the story of the week.
He does. And he picks up the number one song that the rock singer had been singing to make it his own. And with that, he's going to go into the studio and re-record it with some additional lyrics in tribute to the rock singer.
Yeah.
And it's referred to on and off again throughout the remaining issues that there is going to be a music, there's going to be an album released and what have you. So it's quite interesting. And again, that reference that we made about the $1 million insurance taken out on the human fly.
Those lines blur again.
Those lines blur again.
Beautiful. So there was an act called the Human Fly and Red Rider that went around New York and New Jersey. As far as we know, it wasn't Rick Rojat, who seems to have vanished by this point. We'll get to that later. Yeah. It was a guy called David Wolfe, who was actually, here we go again, Cyndi Lauper's boyfriend.
Yes.
And later, he was her manager when she became famous. Again, I can't turn up any audio or any video of this. I've looked. So whether it exists, I don't know. Maybe people could pop it in the comments if it does, so we could have a look at it. But yeah, so apparently he wore a version of the mask or the costume on stage.
Yeah.
And I think it was a country and western type act.
Yeah.
Well, who knows? Well, but that seems to be the last sort of public appearance of anybody Well, certainly in America, anyway, anybody who was, purporting to be the actual character.
Yeah, I mean, Red Rider, interestingly, they were they actually had quite a bit of initial success as a band
Okay.
themselves. Their songs, they were kind of middle of the road rock, and they had songs in films and episode of Miami Vice
Oh, okay.
and stuff like that.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
That I didn't know. That I didn't
So
know.
it's interesting. I wonder if
Same
they were.
characters involved then, David Wolfe, as far as you know. Is
Yeah,
that is
as
that a
far as I
name that's
know.
familiar? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's, some credibility to that part of it then.
So it is interesting again, this blurring and who's who and who's
Yeah,
doing
it's
what.
superb. It's fantastic. Yeah, it's fantastic. So I suppose you come on up. So all that presumably finishes about, I don't know, is this the late set? We're into the late 70s now. You say the comic finished at
Yeah,
issue
late
19, didn't it?
78, I think. Yeah,
Okay.
and again, although there were references in letters pages, and they did launch the fan club, and they did start to gather the poll on what stunt would you like the human flyer to do. And again, in his letter to the comic after his accident, he does refer to these upcoming stunts, and readers can send in ideas and stuff. But I think because then he just vanished from the public eye, there were no more stunts, even though there was promises of it. There was no record contract that ever seemed to have been signed. Sales then started to peter out, and the comic was cancelled at issue 19. Although it did finish on a nice, satisfactory note as a title, they did bring it to an end properly. Although there is reference in the comic to the next issue, which obviously
Okay,
never,
which
and
obviously
then
never
right at the
appeared.
end, so the comic was written while there was still a title to do, but the ending at the end, it says the end, this is the last issue of the Human Fly. There you
So we come
go.
to now. So where is he? What happened to the human fly? I think we know he stopped, but what happened to
Yeah.
Rick Rojack, the guy who seemingly took all the bumps and bruises? I think this is fascinating. There's been a flurry of sort of news articles the past couple of years, but you can go back to the Calgary journalist in 2015, identified a homeless guy called Richard Ro he called himself Richard Ray Rajot as opposed to Rojot.
Yeah.
And he was this cheery, happy guy who hung around at Tim Hortons in the centre of Calgary and just tried to be nice to people. And people would stop and chat to him, buy him a drink, buy him something to eat, etc., etc. And there is a picture of him. There is actually just one picture of him. It may be him, it may not be. I wish I'd have known that, Darren. I was in Calgary 2 months ago. I went in that
Oh.
Tim Hortons. I so would have looked for this guy, right?
Yeah.
So maybe that's him. A recent news article about 12 months ago was centering on Fergus, Ontario, again in Canada. A guy who may have been part of the homeless community or possibly in a kind of retirement home.
Yes.
Who
Now,
knows?
yeah, I mean the bit that I've heard about that is it was his daughter that
That's right. Yeah. And
came
now, and
forward.
obviously, Joe's wife did say that, his,
Yeah.
apparently estranged wife and he had two daughters with. So that could be true. But I think she didn't want to talk to anybody, I think, when I read the article.
No, and I think she also said that I think she confirmed that her father was in the care home, but because of privacy laws in Canada,
Okay.
they weren't able to pursue it any further because she said that he didn't want to speak to anyone, and they weren't allowed under these laws to then dig to see who was in which care home.
Oh, okay.
So they're stuck. So they have to wait until or unless someone rings, Rick rings them directly from the care home, or it's set up that they can go and interview him in the care home by whoever, but they aren't allowed to go and find out whether or not he is
Okay,
actually in.
that's a shame, actually. I mean, as we know, there's a British film company called, I think, Astronaut Films. We're
Yeah, I
actively
think
trying to
so.
gather information to make a documentary movie,
Yeah.
and it is a fascinating story. So, I mean, that's a matter of record. You can find them, you can email them if you've got any information. It'd be interesting to know what they've actually found out, if anything. And I think the rights to the character. I mean, Joe Ramaccieri passed away some
Yeah.
years ago from cancer. There's quite a nice interview with him from about 2002, I think, which you can find online. I think we should point out here that his wife, she said the organised crime mafia connections were a load of rubbish.
Yeah.
She said, you know, Joe liked to think of himself as that kind of guy, you know, sort of in the shadows, controlling things, et cetera, et cetera. But she doubted very much whether he would have had anything to do with organised crime. But who knows? It's a better story with you know,
again,
with
what
that
fact,
involved.
What's fiction?
and we don't know what's fact and what's fiction here. But I mean, there are some new comics. I think it's the guy Tony Babinski, the Montreal guy who owns it. I mean, I haven't read any of the new ones. I've seen the covers; they're quite nice.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're being done on a crowdfunding basis and sold through Amazon. I'll double check that, and if that's the case, I'll put the links up again when we post the episode, so people can go and check that out. Maybe even fund the continuing adventures of the human fly.
Absolutely, yeah.
And
now, I'll
maybe
be honest with you, I haven't read any of the. There was one that I passed to you, the black and white one, from about 10 years ago. To be honest, I actually think the character only really works in the 70s when all this stuff was going on around him, Evel Knievel. And it seems to me he belongs in that era of, you know, Daredevil stuntmen, disco. You know, episodic weekly TV, you know, black exploitation films, call it what you will, kung fu movie, you know, martial arts movies. He seems to fit quite nicely there. I don't, and as I say, I haven't read any of the new stories. I hope they're good, but does he really fit? I think he does have his sidekick, though, in the comics now, doesn't he? Mercury, who seems to have had a sex change and is now a girl.
Yes. I think I haven't read the new ones in detail. I only had a skim through, but I think you're right. I think Mercury is in there, but as
well,
a girl.
You know, the guy Joe Lemo was certainly not in the original Marvel series.
No.
And I guess that's where we end. I mean, I guess it's never it, is it? This is never the end because the story is we just don't know.
No, the whole thing about it is it's the story of him getting into the story of the comics and one of you is a comic book in its own right. It just reads
absolutely.
Like, you know,
I mean, the way, you know, as we've discussed, the way there's, you know, the whole thing interweaves between reality and the printed page, and one seems to feed the other, and you don't quite know what the actual underlying truth is, other than that, you know, real life seems to feed the comic book then seems to feed real life, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, for me, this whole thing is, you know, about being a dreamer. These guys dreamed of something better, you know. Joe, with his, you know, in the meat factory, wanted to be somebody. Rick Rojat, whoever he may be, and, you know, wherever he is, I hope he's well. He was a dreamer as well. All these guys were dreamers. Now, whether they went about achieving their dreams in the right way or whatever, it's something that, you know, we all dream of escaping the 9 to 5 and doing something amazing. And these guys, you know, they had a real good go at that, and they became celebrities for a short period of time. They were on TV, they were in the newspapers, their story travelled all over the world, et cetera, et cetera.
Am I right in thinking that the stunt with the DC-10 has never been repeated? I don't think anyone's ever done that, have they?
I don't think so, no. No, I don't think so. I mean, there's real extensive footage of that particular stunt from different angles. I mean, there's helicopters that are flying alongside the plane, et cetera, et cetera. There was quite a big crowd. I mean, there really wasn't many people there for the second one. The whole concert stunt event was completely undersold.
Yeah.
And that's a matter of record. And I think they discussed that on one of the Canadian chat shows.
Yeah.
And obviously he didn't do any more stunts. But I think for a while he was a real celebrity on sort of talk shows and things. Allegedly he lived a Rick When he was on top of the game, he lived a bit of a rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah. Well, you can't blame him, really.
You know, allegedly. So, more power to him, really. And whilst, you know, in some ways you'd all want like to think, oh, it'd be great if they got hold of him, you know, and he told his story. In another way,
the mystery's better.
The mystery is better, and he's the living embodiment of a secret identity because nobody found him.
it's,
that's, you know, the real life feeds the comic book personality and then feeds
it,
back
it
into real
does.
life.
And it's that whole idea of, you know, art imitating life, but life imitating art. Which one is it? I mean, it just weaves in and out of both those different ideas. And one seems to influence the other, and then the next time it's next month, it's influenced the other way around. It's just the whole thing. And I can heartily recommend to listeners to try and get the Human Fly comics. They're not too expensive. And just for the way that it's positioned and the letters from the Human Fly that are in that in those issues, and people saying, "Oh yeah, we've been to see the stunt review." It's just a slice of comic book history. I don't think will ever be repeated in
No,
any other way.
never, never. I mean, you've had some sort of celebrity comics, but not in this way. One rider to all this, I got a good buddy who was brought up east side of Manchester, and he swears that in the early 80s he saw a travelling stunt show where one of the performers was called the Human Fly. And I think I've told you this before. His final stunt in the show was to, was to be put in a coffin, and they blew him up. But he walked away. Apparently, he walked away from it. So, whether it's the same guy or it's just that whole thing about, let's put a costume on somebody and it's actually somebody else beneath the mask. Who knows? But he swears he saw a human fly stuntman in a stunt show in the 80s at some point.
And was
Kai
that really
Michelson,
good?
yeah, Kai Michelson got the bike back eventually, many years later, and restored it. And apparently, it's now on display in his workshop somewhere in California, so you can actually see that. Truth is stranger than fiction.
It is. And the coffin stunt, was that Rick making one final exclamation mark about
I don't
the
know.
human
It's almost
fly?
it's almost an artistic statement, isn't it?
It is.
That
It's
Mike says that he swears he saw a stunt an act called the Human Fly, and he wore a red suit and a mask, and he got his final stunt was he got blown up in a coffin.
Now,
But
I think we need, I think we should acknowledge a couple of things. Roma Foods are still in business. They're still and they're still a family-owned business, I think, as
I think
well.
so. I think they're quite noted. I think they're quite famous in, in Montreal.
They're quite successful. Obviously, losing the Human Fly Enterprises didn't hurt the business model too much. I mean, at the end of the day, people like sausages. So, but that's not all they do. They've expanded their goods, shall we say, their food goods. And as you said earlier, although the stories keep being pushed about the idea that there was a mafia connection initially with the deal with the human fly in real life, not the comic book, I think again that was just part of the illusion and the mystique that was being pushed by people around him.
I mean the main article I use, the one I always go back to for this, is there's an issue of Esquire magazine from 2014, which is the March 2014. It's an excellent article, and it's the only reference I can see where they talk to Denise Ramisieri, Joe's wife, and she confirms or dispels a lot of the rumors around it. But says it was a wild time. They sold their house to finance this. And she had two little kids and another one on the way. But she said Joe was a dreamer. He dreamed of,
Something better.
something else. The comic stuff I've come up with, and some of the stuff is from, let me just check again. You can put these in the notes. It's Back Issue Magazine number 20, the Secret Identities issue. Boy, oh boy, if that isn't well titled.
Absolutely. It is such a fascinating story. And then also, the other thing we should mention is, although the human fly said that he was doing it to raise money for
Oh,
charities and
yes.
research, I have not been able to find any evidence that any
Okay.
money was ever handed over. But if you think, as you say, that the stunts sometimes were undersold, and I mean, it's not cheap to get a DC-10 flying, even the
No,
permission
no.
to fly, you can actually see that maybe a lot of those stunts ran at a loss. And therefore, there was no money. But what he did do, and he kept on banging on in every interview, especially after the comic came out, was he wanted to show disabled people, especially children, that there was always a way to become better than what life was trying to say they should be. or society was saying they should be. And I think if we want to take any message from this whole crazy story of the human fly, I think it's that he did try to push the awareness that people with disabilities shouldn't be automatically discounted, if that
Yeah,
makes sense.
which is great. And there's certainly footage of him, or possibly the vac or either Rick Rojat or possibly the vacuum cleaner salesman in children's hospitals in Canada signing, meeting kids, signing autographs, etc., etc. So, that side of it seems to be very real. The charity side, who knows, Darren? Who knows what the intentions were? Maybe they were. I mean, I think just before the Montreal motorcycle jump, I think the manager said they spent $50,000 on promotions, and I think there were about 3,000 people in the stadium, so I'm sure they're running at a loss.
Again, this whole mystique thing about him, it's just incredible. And let's hope that one day we can come back and say Rick's done his interview.
I
That would
don't
be
know.
great.
I don't know. I'm not so sure I agree. I'm not so sure I
No.
agree. I think Rick, Rick Rojat, if you're out there, I salute you because you've beaten everybody. You have done what every comic book character seeks to do and maintained your secret identity. We don't know who you are, and we don't know where you are, even though we know your name.
I guess that's a good footnote to end it on.
Anyway, thanks, Darren. That was great.
No, I've enjoyed that again. The part, I mean, as you said, this rabbit hole at the start,
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
you could go on. I mean, there's so many different articles
There's
and
info, there's
references.
misinfo. As I say, the reason why I use the Esquire one is because it's the only one, as far as I can see, where Joe's wife, who must have been pretty, close to the whole thing, and really, why should she not tell the truth?
No, I think you're right there. I think trying to go with the verifiable sources where possible, but also understand that even the verifiable sources have got contradictions in them. So it's find your own path and come to your own conclusion.
Even though even the contradictions are entertaining, though.
They are. Well, thanks, Chris. I really enjoyed that.
Was cool.
And so we leave our heroes as they plan their next adventures in comics. And if they had managed to meet and interview the human fly, we can well imagine what he would say.
Nicely done, boys. But my secret identity must remain. For now, at least, my secret.
And so we invite you to join in the discussion and share your theories or recollections of the human fly, his possible secret identity, or indeed on the Marvel Comics title itself. To do so, go to darreninform.com/thinkworksforum and find the corresponding post on this episode. And remember, do not attempt any of the stunts mentioned in this episode, even if 60% of your body is already metal plating and pins. But, as the human fly himself would probably say,
never be afraid of following your dreams, because who knows just where they may lead you.